Previously on Beta.
This top, I get sick when I look at this top. I'm nauseous now that you've drawn attention to it. I got it in a charity shop down the road. It was full of bullet holes when I bought it. That somebody died in this top.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. When John Waters is not making movies, chances are he's making art.
There's a movie where Elizabeth Taylor gets a facelift and then her stitches kind of look like my mustache. I edit it back and forth, so it's Elizabeth Taylor, me, and then I turn into her and get a facelift and she has my mustache.
The king of bad taste joins us later.
When I got here, it was so familiar to me because I grew up watching American TV shows and reading American books.
Irish comedian and podcaster Maeve Higgins, coming up. Mark Rebo is one of the world's most acclaimed guitarists. Over the course of his 40-year career, he's worked with Elvis Costello, Elton John, and Norah Jones. His latest album is called Songs of Resistance, 1942 to 2018. The album features protest songs ranging from World War II to now. Rebo features several guest vocalists, including Tom Waits, Steve Earle, and Faye Victor. Mark says the roots of his activism date all the way back to his childhood.
It goes back when I was, in second or third grade, and they canceled the Soupy Sales show on television. I organized a walkout from my second grade class. I was a little mystified about the workings of power. Somehow I thought that my teacher could make Soupy Sales go back on the air. It wasn't successful, but that didn't stop me. After Soupy Sales, there was the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. So you've done a lot. You're not the kind of guy who's content to sit on the sidelines. What inspired you to create this new album, Songs of Resistance, 1942 to 2018?
Well, it was immediately inspired by the election of Donald Trump. I was actually working on a different record with my band Ceramic Dog at the time. Somehow we met after Trump's election, and I said, well, we changed the direction in that album, and I also decided to do another one as well, but I guess the thinking was for us that the world could live without another recording of songs about me fighting with my girlfriend for another few years while we dealt with these more pressing problems.
I've read that one of the inspirations for putting this album together, for creating it, was that you noticed that there were all these dedicated political movements, but they didn't have a musical component. Can you talk about that?
I had noticed that, like, long before Donald Trump's election. I would go on demonstrations and people chant the same half a sentence slogan again and again. And no matter how much I agree with it, after a while, I find that, you know, whatever we're marching to create, I might die of boredom before we ever achieve it. So at the same time, we in fact have this wonderful history and heritage of a musical tradition of not just protest music, but resistance music. There's a fine distinction there.
Yeah, what is the distinction?
A protest, whether it's musical or not, recognizes the legitimacy of the authority to which it is protesting. Mm-hmm. A resistance song does not, and exists for another purpose, to energize, instruct, encourage a group which is trying to achieve an objective.
Mm, so would it be fair to say then that a resistance song is more active?
Astra Taylor, who's a wonderful writer and thinker and musician, had a great article about how she hated the word activism, how it had eclipsed the earlier word organizer. I would prefer to see myself as an organizer. Just the idea that activism, you get a gold star for being active, whereas in resistance movements, if you didn't win, you usually got executed. I don't know whether I'm an activist or an organizer, but I know what I do is this. Both musically and politically. I go back and I look at the past and I see how people dealt with similar situations in the past. And I try to find what's useful or fun or what we can take from that for now. Another thing that I noticed that gave me the idea that people needed something like this, I remember being at Occupy. It was rumored that they were going to be evicted by the police. And so there we were at 6:30 in the morning, and everybody was milling around half conscious and waiting to be arrested or whatever was going to happen. And people were nervous and trying to get ready, and they were in need of a song, but nobody, there was no common song they could sing. I was wishing people knew We Are Soldiers in the Army, which is the song that people in the civil rights movement traditionally sung, often while they were being arrested.
We are soldiers in the army. We had to fight, although we have to cry. We had to hold up the bloodstained banner. We've got to hold it up until we die.
Oh, we are soldiers in the army. We have to fight, although we have to cry.
Because that song helped make people brave. The act of singing together helped give people courage. And it also let people know that they're not alone. The people in the paddy wagon can hear the people in the street. The people in the jail cell can hear people in other jail cells. And it also lets us know that we're not alone in history. We have some pretty good company back there.
Let's talk about some of the songs on Songs of Resistance. Can you tell me about Bella Chow, which features Tom Waits?
Yeah, Bella Chow is a World War II era song of the Italian partisans, the partigiani. As with everything else on the record, my goal was not to do an archivally correct version. It's usually done as kind of a really up-tempo, high-spirited march. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Chow, Chow. And I wanted to translate it into English because I wanted people to understand it. The lyrics to the song begin,
"One fine morning, I woke up early. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow. One fine morning, I woke up early. Find the fascists at my door."
I wanted people to understand that other people had a kind of rude awakening before in the past, and this was their song. In fact, it's about a very intimate moment. It's about somebody saying goodbye to their husband and wife. It's without question a political song, but it's also an intimate song.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tom related to that.
Well, one of the most beautiful songs on the album is The Militant Ecologist, which features a very melancholy, moving vocal performance by Michelle Nadeggio-Cello.
Nadeggio-Cello, that's right. Michelle is a great singer.
Yes, she is.
And an equally excellent or an amazing bass player,
yeah,
songwriter, and musician. And I've known Michelle for some years, and I was thrilled that she agreed to do this tune.
The wind that howls, the storm outside is raging. Our shoes are broken, still we must go on. The war we fight, so long before our liberty, just the possibility of a future.
The inspiration for that tune was another Italian partisan song called Fischia il Vento. What happened was I translated Fischia il Vento in using my very inexpert Italian, and I kept working with it melody-wise, trying to change some things about it. Fischia il Vento is about a partisan fighter going on a mission. I changed the gender of the partisan fighter. He's now a she. I changed the mission a little bit. The flag that flies in the end is the green flag. This fighter is not marching into the red dawn. I kept the spirit of the song. I changed a lot of the music, most of the music.
Mm-hmm.
I just let it keep morphing, and it morphed into a different tune. And that's how Fischia Il Vento gave birth to The Militant Ecologist.
You wrote a song called How to Walk in Freedom, and this song features Sam Amidon and Faye Victor, and the opening lines are,
come back, Rosa Parks, from the back of the bus, take the wheel from this idiot, steer us back on the road.
Can you tell me what inspired you to write this song?
Wish fulfillment. It's just naked wish fulfillment. You know, again, it's the theme of the record that we're interrogating the past, where I'm asking the past to give us a clue of what to do now.
Yeah.
One thing that I've noticed is that in a lot of civil rights tunes and a lot of other songs, there's the act of walking together. And somehow walking together is a radical act. When you think, who can you walk to? Where can you walk? And what you can sing while you're walking, you can make some progress there.
I want to ask you about the song Srinivas, which is sung by Steve Earle and Tift Merritt.
Dark was the night, cold was the ground, when they shot down.
You wrote this one. Can you tell me about it?
I was doing my best to channel something deep from American song in this record. And that song was inspired by a very old song, I think 1600s, a hymn, Dark the Night, Cold the Ground. And there's a very famous version on instrumental version on solo guitar by Blind Willie Johnson that anybody who knows the history of guitar would know. It's an amazing piece of music. And so, well, I was using both some of the words from the hymn and some of the motifs from the melody. The words from the hymn are, dark the night, cold the ground. And the original words are, when they laid our Savior down, but I used when they shot Srinivas Kuchibhatla down. The song refers to something that actually happened. An anti-Muslim bigot walked into a bar, I think it was in Kansas, and shot two men because he believed they were Muslim. In fact, I think they were Hindu. But that didn't much matter to this guy. Anyways, Srinivas Kuchibhatla died, and it was in the news, and I turned on the news, and I saw his mother was being interviewed, and she was crying, and I felt like we owed her a song.
But a stranger shot Srinivas down, screaming, get out.
You sing a song called The Big Fool, and this clearly seems to be a song about climate change. Can you tell me about The Big Fool?
Yeah, The Big Fool actually, it comes from a song called, I think, Up to Our Necks in the Big Muddy, and which was actually something that's kind of rare, which is a U.S. Second World War protest song against the arbitrary authority of this captain who ordered his soldiers in a training exercise to cross a river called the Big Muddy, even though it was too deep and they were carrying heavy equipment, and several of the soldiers drowned. This was a song from that era. Pete Seeger, in the 60s, updated it and used it as a metaphor for the increasing U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. We're up to our knees, we're up to our waists, we're up to our necks in the Big Muddy, and the Big Fool says, push on. I kept the lyrics, the Big Fool says, push on, and I changed the subject to climate change.
And the permafrost is melting, and the glaciers are receding, the extinctions are beginning, and the Big Fool says, push on. And the rich buy private islands, or the food in luxury bunkers, and they'll pay their private islands.
What do you want people to take away from listening to Songs of Resistance?
I hope they'll listen to it and like it. I hope people will feel empowered to do the process that I've done, which is to go to the past, go to the musics of the past, go to the history of the past, and learn it, see what's there, take what's useful, and use it now. And that goes for the music of the past. It also goes for lessons we can take away from the politics of the past. This record was inspired politically by the idea of a popular front. That's how the last fight against fascism was won. And that needs to be remembered now, that people were able to work together to defend something that was very important and still is very important.
Good people of Missouri thought John Brown was insane. Meanwhile, in their backyards, they had human beings in chains.
Mark Rebo is a musician and the man behind the album Songs of Resistance, 1942 to 2018. You can find out more about Mark at wpr.org/beta.
There was a real art school in Baltimore that I saw the sign for years, and it said study art for fun or profit. The two most artistically incorrect things you would ever say in the serious art world while you studied art.
The inimitable movie maker John Waters joins us to talk about his secret career as an artist.
He had 200 rifles riding by his side.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. John Waters has been called all kinds of names throughout his career. Pope of Trash, Prince of Puke. That's because John is famous and infamous for his transgressive cult films. Movies like Multiple Maniacs, Pink Flamingos, and Female Trouble. But Waters is also an artist. The Baltimore Museum of Art is hosting a major retrospective for their local boy who's made good or bad. Or both. It's called Indecent Exposure and features John's art, including photographs, sculptures, and videos that he's made since the early 1990s. A word of warning, some of our conversation contains mature material. So, John, you took photographs with real film, and you took these photos of images on the television?
Yeah, without stopping it or freeze-framing it or anything. Yes, in the beginning. They weren't digital. Digital doesn't work. I still have tried it off the TV screen with digital. It doesn't work right.
Why not?
It just doesn't look right to me. It doesn't have that amateur kind of feel. It doesn't look like an early underground movie. It doesn't look like somebody snuck in and made a piece of art in the middle of the night in a closed theater where they put the print on themselves without asking or hijacked the projectionist or something.
Yeah, that element of subterfuge is missing.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, you're basically putting together storyboards that tell a new narrative, or else you're composing a new movie from sometimes your images, from other directors' images.
Yeah, completely. It's like a snipe hunt. I think up the narrative of each piece before I ever do them. So I guess you could call it the dreaded conceptual art. And then I have to find the images for each thing to be able to tell the story. Sometimes it doesn't work, and I take those images and keep them. I have many, many little envelopes of different subject matters or backgrounds or everything. And then I write with them and I edit with them, with those pictures, to tell a new story. So something I took that didn't work might end up, you know, 10 years later in another sequence that I'm using to tell another story.
Can you describe an example of one of your favorite My Little Movies works that we can see in your new exhibition?
There's a movie where Elizabeth Taylor gets a facelift in it, and her stitches kind of look like my mustache, I noticed. So I edit it back and forth, like, so it's Elizabeth Taylor, me, and then I turn into her and get a facelift with, and she has my mustache. So it's kind of morphing other images into a completely different narrative than there was in the original movie.
And do you have a title for that one?
That one is called Facelift, I think.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
And then I have another one, Santa Molester, and it's from a really innocent child's movie.
Uh-huh.
But the way I photographed it, Santa's looking in the window and the kid's in there and everything. And then when the Santa comes in, the kid falls to his knees and runs over and hugs Santa. But just the way I edited it makes the most innocent children's movie look completely, almost pornographic in a completely innocent way. You don't see one thing. It's a G-rated movie.
I'm curious about why you felt compelled to start creating fine art. Was part of the motivation the fact that when you do that, you're in total control, whereas when you're making a film, you're working with all these other people, it's so collaborative?
A little. I mean, anti-fine art. Yes, it's very different. When, you know, you watch a movie or you see artwork or you see a movie and you watch, yeah, you more you watch a movie and see an art piece. But I was trying to tell a story in a much quicker way. Talk about the high concept, you know, it's like two frames.
Yeah.
That's it. But it's also something that you're going to look at forever if you have it hanging in your house. So it's very different from even a cult movie. People might have seen it 10 times. They don't look at it every single day of their life when they look up from their bed or something. So I tried to imagine that too. Pieces that wouldn't always be something that people would want to hang over their sofa. Because my collectors, they understand that I'm satirizing the whole art business in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between the kinds of reactions you're trying to get from the people who watch your films versus the people who experience your fine art?
Completely. I never mix them at all. Even where I think up my photographs is a whole different place than where I write my movies or shows or books.
Well, so what's the difference?
It's different because the art world, the only obscenity left is celebrity. And I hate celebrity artists, too. So basically, I try to debase that and ruin my celebrity. But at the same time, I've never given an article in, like, say, People magazine or something where I routinely do, you know, press for the movies about my art career, really. I like to keep them very, very separate. Many people that are fans of my movies probably don't even know I have that, even though there are 4 art books out about my work. I guess it gets less and less like that. But still, I like to keep it separate because I think it is a very separate thing. I think it up in a whole different place. I still collect art. I still go to art galleries all the time. And it's just as important to me, but it's different.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that you're still going after shock value, trying to surprise people?
Well, all contemporary art is made to wreck what came before. So there's always a little bit of shock value in contemporary art. And I have a piece in the show that says contemporary art hates you, because it does. And people have great fear of contemporary art. And so it can hate you and you have to love it for it. And then the hate can't hurt. And then you buy it and then you put it on your wall. I think Ileana Sutherland, one of the most famous collectors, they always asked her, how did you build this great, great collection? She said, I just bought what I hated. and I understand that in a way. Because all the art that put the movement before it out of business made fun of it. And like the soup can was greeted with outrage and minimalism. All of these things happened when they first came out. Abstract expressionism was made fun of by the public, certainly, in the beginning. And that's what you need in the beginning, is to have a controversy that says, this is it, it's gone too far.
Just the other day, I was at Target with my wife, and the soup can idea has really been domesticated, because there was the Campbell's soup can with Mickey Mouse's 90th birthday on the label.
Yeah, well, that was pop art. Certainly started with cartoon characters, really.
That's true. Good point. I want to ask you about a work that you created, I think in 2006. It's called Faux Video Room. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Collectors today, video art is very popular, but still not embraced by every collector, because when they're going to 20 art shows and they walk in, they think, oh, God, how long is it? I have to go in this dark room for 40 minutes and watch some arty thing. So mine is called Faux Video Room. It looks like one. You get the doorway, the curtain, you hear sound behind it, but you paint the wall black. And so there isn't really a room, but you can pretend that you collect video art, too, for other collectors when they're over, especially if you don't have the room.
Then when you go beyond the curtain, there's
a
wall.
You would paint the wall black.
Right.
But you'd be surprised. In every show that piece has been in, we have to repaint it 3 or 4 times. Because people, even though they see that it's a black wall, they keep trying to get in. They refuse to believe it isn't a video room.
It's like the guy who fell in that black hole recently.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah, yeah. That was kind of art. Didn't he fall in an art piece? Yeah, yeah. Well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Made with a special paint, because he thought it wasn't a real hole. So it's sort of a Wile E. Coyote thing.
Well, contemporary art hated him.
Yeah. but getting back to Faux Video Room for a moment, there's a soundtrack that plays when you confront the wall.
There is, but it doesn't really matter what the sound is, because you just needed the muffled sound so it sounded like that there was sound behind there that would trick you to go in. It is actually the final suicide in Jonestown that was actually, I bought the album of that. There was an album called The Last Supper that was sold in the New York Times classified section. And that is what's playing in the back, but you could have any sound, really, although once you know it's that, it makes it a little more, I guess, awkward for fellow collectors.
Well, are you concerned concerned about the ethics of incorporating audio of people committing suicide into that work, or is that part of the point of the piece?
No, I think it was, well, certainly I didn't order them to do it.
I know, but you know what I mean, just playing it, and say if some relatives...
I just came from the John Waters camp, which is this big thing we have every year at a real camp where all my fans come and they stay for the whole weekend, and the t-shirt says Jonestown with a happy ending. So that's what it was anyway. But no, I just needed something strong, a sound there, and it just happened at the time, so I had to use something. So yes, I was always going to add something that gave it a little extra edge, certainly.
In an essay that's included in the exhibition catalog, the curator Kristen Heilman says that in Faux Video Room, quote, you are equating the actions of those who follow a cult leader to their deaths with the quest for artistic novelty and enlightenment undertaken by believers indoctrinated in the rituals of museum, biennial, art fair, and gallery attendance, end quote. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, people with art, I love art writing, and I love
Me
the
too.
Stretch it goes. So basically, I wouldn't say she was wrong. Was I thinking that when I did the piece? No.
Yeah.
But I was certainly satirizing art collectors and what they could collect and what that they could put in your home, and how hard it is to display video art in your house unless you really do have a video room, which very few people do. So I think Kristen's essay is great. I think it's very intellectual. But I love that. I love... Even impenetrable art writing, I'm a fan of.
Yeah, and that is quite penetrable. What other sound works are included in the Indecent Exposure exhibition?
There's one called Sound of a Hit that I recorded in the Senator Theater in Baltimore in the box office opening day of Harry Potter.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing today? Can I get 3 tickets for tomorrow's 1 o'clock showing?
Okay, tomorrow the 20th.
You know, it's the sound of selling tickets and money being exchanged for an hour, which I thought was kind of perfect for any showbiz person's office or something.
Yeah, that's great. Any other ones that come to mind?
Let me see. Any other ones that have a sound? I'm trying to remember. I know that one does. There's another piece I have that sort of mocks the insurance regulations of many museums, that where you go in, I don't know if you've ever seen, if a collector has it and it's worth so much money, the piece, they have like this kind of area that's kind of bugged in front of it. So if you get too close to it, a buzzer goes off or something for insurance reasons.
Yeah.
Well, mine squirts you in the face with water if you get too close.
Yeah, isn't it called Hardy Har?
It is. I'm pushing to see can art be serious and funny.
Yeah.
And it always reminds me of Candid Camera when people get squirted in the face in a museum. They scream. They jump back.
It seems to me that one of the differences between your film career and your fine art career is that a lot of your fine art is making fun of the contemporary art world, while your films are not so much making fun of the film genre, but then...
Oh, I think they each one makes fun of a film genre.
Yeah. Having said that, I now realize I could be entirely wrong about this, so
I mean, each one. Think of it about... Hairspray was a dance movie. Crybaby was a musical. Serial Mom was a true crime thing. A Dirty Shame was sexploitation. I think each one took a genre. I think when you say I'm making fun of it, I only make fun of things I love in this show and in all my work, really. I'm never a harsh... The only time I ever say negative stuff about something is if everyone else but me loves it.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorites of your digs at contemporary art world is your series of study art signs. Can you tell me about them?
Well, they were all based. There was a real art school in Baltimore that I saw the sign for years, and it said study art for fun or profit. I think of both the two most artistically incorrect things you would ever say in the serious art world while you studied art.
Yeah.
So I tried to use that, but it was done with no irony. I believe the school probably was for people that wanted to be kind of Sunday painters or maybe get in the business of illustration or something. So they had no interest in going into the contemporary art world that I follow. That to them, they probably would have no interest and think it was just really bad. So I just was fascinated by it, and I looked at it every day. So I did the sign, and with 5 different slogans, prestige or spite or other things, bounty, and things that you would also never say in the art world.
Yeah, I love that one. Study art for prestige or spite. That's my favorite.
Well,
it's great.
That's more, I think some of the art world would admit to that.
Oh, yeah, that's what, it's funny because it's true. And then there's study art for reading or bounty, study art for pride or power, study art for fun or fame. What's the 5th one? Do you remember?
No, not offhand, but there's five of them, yeah.
The way you satirize the contemporary art scene in your work, I can't help but think of Otessa Moshfegh and her new novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation.
Which I loved, and I loved her first novel, Eileen, really a lot, too. She's a great, great writer, yeah.
You wrote a review of her short story collection for the New York Times, I think.
Well, I think I mentioned how much I liked it. Yeah, she's great. She's really one of the best writers. Her and Rachel Cusk are my two favorites.
Yeah, I've got to read Rachel Cusk. There was that great line in your review of Homesick for Another World where you said, quote, Homesick for Another World will scorch you like a blowtorch, end quote. Is that what you want John Waters' art to do?
No, I think not, because mine, I hope you, hardy har har, I hope you... You go back and want to see more contemporary art that you maybe at first would hate, and at the same time realize that it is an elite world that is easy to parody, but at the same time one that's a secret world that you can learn the language, and once you go to art galleries enough, you see everything in a completely different way. You walk down the street, you look at garbage, you think of an artist that does garbage, you look at a dirty car, you think of someone that paints cars, and it continues to last the more art you see. And eventually, whenever you go out, everything looks like art. Which isn't that perfect.
You also have this series of photos with captions over top, and this series is called Artistically Incorrect. Can you tell me about this series?
Right. That's like art terms that very much are insider art. Like, we don't do discounts. You know, most all collectors know that if you buy something and you're a good collector, they'll give you 10% off. But mine says, like, no discounts. Or the one I wanted to use the year that I had that piece in the show, I wanted to use it as the full-page ad in Art Firm. But even my gallery said no. It just said, all photographs fade. Because...
Yeah, and then your child probably could do this.
Well, that's a tired one where people said my child could have done this. Well, he should have, stupid. It just sold for $1 million.
Yeah.
You should have encouraged him. I taught a class in Baltimore in a grade school. I taught a couple times a year, and we did art, and we had Cy Twombly drawings where they all blindfolded themselves and scribbled. They completely understood it. Not one of them said, this is ridiculous. They understood contemporary art perfectly.
Mm. I was surprised to read in an interview that you learned about shock value while you were being taught writing in grade school. Shock value, of course, being the idea of getting people's attention by saying something horrifying, which you're the master of. That seems to be awfully early to be learning something
like
that.
No, it was in Calvert School, and it was different ways to write. We had to always, things I really did learn there. We had to write a letter to apply for a job. We had to write a sympathy letter. We had to write a thank you letter, which I still do, and not by email. And there were different terms, you know, like alliteration. And
yeah.
But shock value was a term that I guess I paid too much attention to. It was to suddenly say something very surprising or outrageous to get people's attention to what you're saying. And that was the name of my first book. Yeah, so I did pay attention that day in English class.
Obviously, yeah, for sure. I wish my grade school had taught shock value. Maybe they didn't. I just didn't remember it. But anyway, in an essay for your exhibition catalog, Jonathan D. Katz says that, quote, of all the autobiographical themes that pulse beneath the surface of Waters' art, the most central has to be his queerness, end quote. Would you agree with that?
Sort of, yeah, but even though I have a piece to say gay is not enough, because anymore it's not. It's a good start, but certainly I'm against separatism of any kind. I think people should come in, come out, get an operation to be a different sex and decide they don't want to go back to another one. I'm for mixing everybody together. I don't cry that gay bars are closing, because I think if I was young, I don't want to be segregated. Separate is not equal.
Yeah.
Everybody, all the cool kids want to hang around with each other. They don't care anymore. So I think that I'm against separatism, but certainly queerness in the way that you can be straight and be queer in a weird way if you don't fit in and you're bizarre and that you have very, very different tastes and a style. So yes, I would say that it has some in there that I use for humor, but I wouldn't say it's a gay art show.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite example of how your queerness plays out in your art in the exhibition?
Well, there's one. I don't know if this is in the show or not. It's called Boys Beware. I think it is. I'm not sure. And it's all pictures from sex education movies about warning kids not to hitchhike because gay men would pick them up. And the actor in it looks exactly like me.
Interesting.
Which I thought was really bizarre.
Then people are going to think, people would think, oh, it's you, like that you've
morphed. Well, no, but they could tell it's from the 50s. It just oddly does look like me. It's called Boys Beware.
John Waters, film director and contemporary artist.
a major retrospective of his work, Indecent Exposure, is featured at the Baltimore Museum of Art. You can find out more about John at WPR.org/beta.
It's useful to be on the outside looking in, I think. And it certainly helps me to understand the place a little bit more, both here and back in Ireland, I think, when you have that distance.
Irish comedian Maeve Higgins joins us to talk about making a new life for herself here in America. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta.
You see, my mother thinks that she's cool for reasons that I don't think are very cool. Like, my mother thinks she's super cool because if there's loud noises made in rapid succession, she can count them quite quickly in her mind. Like, if there's a knock on the door, it's like, then she's like, four, definitely, Dave, get that. Or if there's machine gun fire on television, if it's like, then she's like, 3, 11, and 2. She like looks around the room at our faces as if we're going to be like, oh my God, what are you? And only because my dad is such a kind man and he loves her so much, he sometimes takes like a fake minute to pretend to count up the noises himself. So he's like, it was 3, 11, and 2, love? It was 3, 11, how on earth, how do you do that? That's incredible. What is that, like a photographic sound memory or something? Jesus Christ. She's like, I don't know, I can just do it. I don't know how or why, but I can.
That's comedian Maeve Higgins. As you may have figured out from Maeve's lovely accent, she's from Ireland. She's the author of Maeve in America, Essays by a Girl from Somewhere Else. Glamour magazine wrote that if Tina Fey and David Sedaris had a daughter, she would be Maeve Higgins. Maeve is a big fan of the multiverse theory, so I asked her to assume that there is some alternate universe in which Tina Fey and David Sedaris are in fact Maeve's parents.
My mother would be like maybe 12 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So that would be fascinating.
That would be weird, wouldn't it?
You know, when people are like, my mom's my best friend.
Yeah.
I would love to be best friends with Tina Fey. But also, maybe I would get to live with David Sedaris and his partner, Hugh. I do not know them personally, but I read all of his work and I love the sound of their relationship. So maybe I could like help David pick up the trash from the like English countryside, and Hugh would make me delicious meals, and I'm sure my life would be way better than it is now, where it's just me and my dog fighting over Cheerios in my apartment.
Excellent answer. And I imagine that at this very moment some crazy Canadian interviewer is asking the other Maeve Higgins about some alternate universe in which Tina Fey and David Sedaris are not her parents. So you're originally from Cove in County Cork, and that's where you began your comedy career. You even had your own television program, Maeve Higgins Fancy Vittles. Why did you decide to move to New York City?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have had a great life in Ireland. I left, I think I was 31 when I left, because I suppose, like you mentioned, I had a TV show and I wrote a book and everything while I was there. But Ireland is very small, and I think I kind of ran out of opportunities a little bit because Ireland is small. And, you know, lots of reasons. I think I was drawn to come to New York, which is still, you know, a big comedy center, and it's like I had a romantic idea of kind of being a writer in New York City. So I really moved for the same reasons a lot of immigrants leave, which is opportunity and adventure.
Yeah. And that this is a good time to talk about this. Maeve in America, it's not only the name of your book of essays, it's also the name of this podcast about immigration that you host. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to do this? Obviously, part of it would be the fact that you're an immigrant yourself, but I imagine there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, for sure. When I first moved here, I think I was really drawn to other immigrants, because I think when you're new in a place and you're trying to find your feet, you know, the other new people, like, they're great comfort to you and guide. And also just from like a storytelling point of view, if you leave one place and start a whole new life in another country, then instantly there's a story there, isn't there? Like, there's a journey. So I was drawn to immigrants, the kind of adventure of that. And I suppose, you know, so many comedians have podcasts.
Yes.
But I never wanted to do one. I certainly had offers before. I never wanted to do one that was just like comedians talking about like how they got started in comedy or whatever. I think that's ground is well trodden.
Mm-hmm.
So one strange thing about, like, you know, I live in New York and 45% of New Yorkers are born in a different country, but like I don't hear them. I only hear American voices on, you know, a lot of media, like podcasts and TV and radio. So I thought it'd be cool to like have a platform where immigrants got to tell their own story. So that was kind of my motivation. I didn't realize, like, you know, myself and my producer were kind of coming up with the idea and working on it throughout 2015, and then it got picked up in, I think, like the summer of 2016. So, you know, I didn't realize then how immigration has always been such a heated political topic in America.
Yeah.
But it obviously ramped right up with, you know, a president that was elected on an anti-immigrant ticket, and then somebody who's gone after, you know, the administration has gone after immigrants in such a kind of brutal way. I didn't know that was going to happen when I started to do the podcast, certainly. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite guest that you've had on your podcast?
Well, somebody's story who really stuck with me was Zaza. His name is Muhammad Zaza, but like everyone just calls him Zaza because in his school there was like 50 Muhammads. So He's a luggage salesman here in Midtown in New York, and he is also a Syrian asylum seeker. And the reason I liked him and I liked just spending time with him was because, well, actually, he kind of reminds me of one of my uncles.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Also because, yeah, even though he's like the same age as me, but there's just something about him that reminds me of my uncle. He makes like dad jokes and he's kind of goofy. But the thing that was cool about him was you hear all about like Syrian refugees and Syrian asylum seekers, and currently Syrians are banned from entering the US. And then you meet Zaza and he's just like, you know, a chubby guy in his 30s.
I spoke to my wife. I told her it's either we will end up in a refugee camp or we'll take this and go. And it was not guaranteed because B-1 visa, the officer in the States can reject me and send me back home. So it was a risk.
Mm.
And we took the flight and it was the longest 16 hours in my life. Seeing all your dreams, all your memories, all your families.
Where did you fly to?
Chicago. They told us it's a good airport.
People like him have been banned. They've been demonized so much that they've been banned from the country.
Mm.
And then just to meet him and just see his day-to-day life, and I think that was hugely valuable for me, you know, as somebody who's interested in Syria and as somebody who's interested in, you know, where we're headed with immigration in this country. And also he's just like a fun, lovely person to spend time with, you know, him and his family.
Mm, yeah. You have this essay in your book called Small Talk, in which you say that, quote, the best parts of a person are buried too deep to be uncovered by as blunt an instrument as a direct question, end quote. So that leads me to wonder, does that mean I should be asking you indirect questions if I want to discover the best parts of you?
Possibly. I mean, in an interview situation, it's a little bit different
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we both like understand what's happening. But I think if I just met you at a party or like a friend's dinner or something, what I find tough to deal with is like this kind of like, okay, how do you know Sarah? Where do you work? What do you work as? Like these kind of like direct sort of questions that I feel are maybe like designed to like put me into onto whichever shelf I belong on, you know, status wise or work wise.
Yeah,
or,
what do you do for a living? Yeah,
you know, and I live in New York, and I think it can be quite transactional. Like interactions with people are sort of like, are you important or not? And I think that's understandable. You know, this is like a big, ambitious city, and it's like a center for capitalism, and like time is, you know, short, and energy is short. So, but what I love to do, and I think I'm sure it's probably from being Irish, is just kind of wander around in conversation and not be so direct. And I think small talk is the kind of perfect little in-between space where you actually do get to know somebody. You just might know, you know, concrete facts about them. Like you might know where, you know, like where they work or where they're from or whatever, but you get to know them, I think, in more subtle ways. And I didn't realize what a kind of precious commodity that was until I kind of felt the loss of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Do you still consider yourself an outsider here in America?
Well, you know, I've been here for 5 years, mm-hmm. and in ways that when I got here, it was so familiar to me because I grew up watching American TV shows and reading American books, and it was so familiar. The longer I stay here, the more the place mystifies me. Mm. It's funny, isn't it? Like, the more I learn about it, I kind of think, wait, what? How did that come to be? Or like, why do people get uncomfortable when I mention this? Or, you know.
Yeah. I've been here. Sorry to interrupt, Maeve. I've been here like almost 19 years now. And it continues to baffle me. And things, there are things that the more I'm here, the longer I'm here, in some ways, the more confused I am about.
Really?
A little bit, yeah. So
are you a citizen now?
No, I'm an alien of extraordinary ability, which is what you are too, right? And I wanted to ask you about that because I kind of like that. I think I'd like to say that that's one of the few, that's a mistake that the U.S. government didn't make. And I've always thought of myself as an alien, but since I tend to struggle with self-doubt, I often question the extraordinary ability part. So if you don't mind my asking, what do you think of being considered an alien of extraordinary ability? Do you like that?
It's a very useful visa, you know, and I do qualify for it, but it definitely, you know, made me question a lot of things. Like, it made me question, well, like, how come I'm allowed to be here? And there's like an astrophysicist sitting in a, you know, refugee camp in Jordan who's not allowed to be here. Or it also made me think about how we categorize people and like, who am I more valuable than, you know, a disabled child who like has yet to prove that they can do, you know, that they can achieve something extraordinary? Or, you know, it's very tricky.
Yeah, it is tricky.
When you get into it.
Yeah, I had this shortly after I got my green card, after I went to Winnipeg, which is where my wife's from, and for a visit above North Dakota, and we came back in, the customs, the U.S. Customs Guard was kind of scoffing, but saying, you have this, your extraordinary ability? Are you as good as the Rolling Stones? And what I should have said, I was too slow-witted, what I should have said, well, yeah, I'm better than Rolling Stones circa Steel Wheels, but I didn't think of it till later. Yeah, burn, yeah. Getting back to this idea of the outs.
You would have been deported immediately.
Yeah, I would have. And it's still probably going to happen. I am on double secret probation here, so it could happen any time. But getting back to the outsider thing, I wanted to ask you, isn't there part of you that doesn't want to let go of the feeling of being an outsider, you know, since comedians often tend to be outsiders? Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah. It's certainly useful, isn't it, as a writer, as, you know, a comedian observing. And feeling like that little bit on the fringes. Good point. I mean, I don't, it's also weirdly, I feel like I can see Ireland more clearly from here too. Mm. Like that it's made me a bit of an outsider in Ireland where I grew up and spent most of my adult life.
And is that a good feeling? Is that a bad kind of I would get the sense that you'd be kind of sad about that or not necessarily?
It's a bit of a mix. You know, I have that Irish ability to always be like melancholy and happy at the same time.
Yeah. But you go back for Christmas every year, don't you?
I do. I go back and, you know, I do feel sometimes like when I'm in Dublin where I lived for many years, I feel like a bit of a ghost kind of like haunting the place. And I'm like, I don't belong here anymore. But like you mentioned, it's useful to be on the outside looking in, I think. And it certainly helps me to understand the place a little bit more. Both here and back in Ireland, I think, when you have that distance.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's next for you?
So right now I'm writing. I'm, you know, writing for the New York Times and I'm contracted with them. So I'm going to write a lot more, I think, about climate change.
Okay.
And then I'm also making a fictional podcast. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about that or it's too soon?
No, I can. It's going to be on Audible and it's about immigration. So myself and my writing partner are just writing it now because I was so sad to lose my other podcast, the one we talked about that was about immigrants. It was immigrants telling their own stories.
Yeah, it's not on anymore, right? You just did two seasons
and we didn't get commissioned again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all there for people to listen to, but I would have loved to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think fiction might be a more interesting sort of a way to like worm into people's hearts.
Yes.
Because I think there's such a gap between if you don't care, making people care about something that doesn't affect them is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I guess making people do anything. But I think that certainly there's this gap in... understanding or like empathy for immigrants here in America. And I think now that so many groups of immigrants are under attack, I'm trying to figure out other ways to kind of make sure people know that we're just human. So maybe fiction can help that, you know.
Maeve Higgins is a comedian, podcaster, and the author of Maeve in America, Essays by a Girl from Somewhere Else. That does it for this edition of Beta. Catch up on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Could you turn that racket down? I'm trying to iron in here.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
It's rather obvious which category you fit into. Have a nice day.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
If you think you're nervous now, wait till you're on the air.